This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to you who are at home. So we're continuing our study of the 37 verses of Dogme Zampo. And so tonight I wanted to focus on verse 7, which is taking refuge. And perhaps get into the next one, the 8th verse as well. So just to sort of remind ourselves and put this into the context in which these teachings were presented, or the order in which they were presented. So he begins by talking about, you know, the recognition of having this human life, this precious human body, that allows us to hear and reflect on and practice the Dharma. And then we take a kind of a tour through those things in our lives that tend to bring forth the most attachments. People, both friends and enemies, places. You having trouble there? Okay. You're okay? Okay. Have they been cut off?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Trying to silence her laptop.
Okay. So then he talks about negative places that are tend to create negative mind states. He talks about possessions. And then the last verse we looked at was he talked about relying on a spiritual friend, a teacher. And so now in this verse, he says, themselves captives in the prison of samsara, cyclic existence, whom can the worldly gods protect? Therefore, to seek refuge in those who do not deceive, that is the three jewels, is the practice of a bodhisattva. And so in a sense, he's been presenting us with these parts of our life, people, places, things, in which we get entangled. And we can get entangled in pleasure, we can get entangled in pain, but how easily we can get entangled. And then there's been an emphasis on going to a secluded place, on solitary practice, on turning in. And so now he brings us to the three treasures, taking refuge. And he invokes cyclic existence. So samsara means to wander, to spin in existence. And so, you know, traditionally and throughout the history of Buddhism, this was really understood within the scheme of an infinite number of lifetimes, virtually. Innumerable lifetimes stretching all the way back into the, you know, uncountable past. And that in each of those existences, our consciousness, right, which is not the self, but our consciousness took form in some being that exists within the six realms. So a hell realm, a hungry ghost, animal realm, human, one of the gods' realms. But even if we're in a godly realm, we're still in cyclic existence because we're still caught up in that cycle of grasping and disappointment. And so he's saying from within that prison, that ongoing, continual cycle, and so we could also look at that in terms of our own lifetimes, present lifetimes, and the cycles that we have seen ourselves go through, fall into, struggle to break those cycles. Captives in that cycle of existence, whom can the worldly gods protect? And so why is taking refuge so central to Buddhism? In a sense, we can say that taking refuge in the three treasures is, in a sense, Buddhism, is really what makes all of these teachings and the practices and the understanding that we have of them uniquely Buddhist. I said that in the early days and period of the Buddha's teaching that he ordained people by having them take refuge. They are the first of our Bodhisattva precepts. They are present within virtually every ceremony we do. At first, an invocation of the three treasures, and then taking refuge. And so, what is this? And to think about, you know, why is he bringing us to this now, having sort of encountered all of these things that are part of our lives where we get entangled? And so, Khyentse Rinpoche says, echoing teaching of Dogen's, but I'll read Khyentse's comment on this. He says, people naturally search for refuge, for someone or something to protect them from sorrow and torment. Some people turn to the powerful with the hope of achieving wealth and pleasure and influence. Others seek protection through natural forces, such as stars or mountains. Some seek aid through the power of spirits. But none of these mistaken objects of refuge are free from ignorance and samsara, and therefore they can't provide ultimate refuge. Their compassion, that is, their liberative value that they might have, if any, is partial and limited, temporary. He says, true refuge can only be provided by something that is itself totally free. And this is really an essential point. That if we're seeking to be free, then we should be turning towards that which is in and of itself free. Free from the bonds of samsara and free from the limited peace of a one-sided nirvana. This quality of true refuge is to be found only in the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, with their absolute wisdom, unbiased compassion, and unimpeded ability. And it's significant when he talks about free from the limited peace of one-sided nirvana that Nagarjuna very importantly, significantly taught that nirvana and samsara are non-dual. So in early Buddhism, nirvana is a release from samsara, is in a sense the escape from samsara, is breaking that cycle of being in samsara. Nagarjuna said they're one. They're the same reality. They're fundamentally not different. And so here he's making the point that, in a sense, he's saying we will take refuge. Human beings will take refuge in something. And he talks about it in terms of gaining influence or power or protection. But I think also we could think of it in terms of finding belonging, community, purpose, meaning, a sense of connecting with something that's larger than ourselves that we feel like gives a sort of meaning to our lives. And I think if we look and just sort of observe, that we'll see that it seems to be an irrepressible search that human beings have to take refuge in something. And what Khyentse is saying is that if we take refuge in something which is itself suffering, then whatever it is, its capacity to free us of suffering is going to be limited. And so only what is free of the three poisons can provide ultimate refuge. And Nagarjuna is teaching about it not being free of samsara, but also free of a one-sided nirvana, is really the merging of relative and absolute, right? It's really, he's talking about the unity of conventional reality and ultimate reality, that that's the essence of the three treasures. Dogen has a fascicle on the three treasures, which is very interesting. In the very beginning, he says, taking refuge is achieved through mutual affinity and interaction. Mutual affinity and interaction. When you have that, when there is mutual affinity and interaction, wherever you find yourself, whatever realm of existence you might turn up in, you can take refuge. In other words, taking refuge is not limited in any way to whatever circumstance you might find yourself in. But it's based on a mutual affinity and interaction. And I think what's so interesting about the three treasures in taking refuge is, what is it? Right? What is it? Right? So we're given instructions on how to meditate. Right? When it's time to do liturgy, you pick up a sutra book. When it's time to bow, you let your body go to the ground. There's these various practices, but what is, how would you describe, what is taking refuge? Right? So there's the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha means we really have to examine what are those treasures. Right, if you're going to take refuge in something, you should know, right? Is it trustworthy? Is it those things? Are they those things that are worthy of your taking refuge because they are free of the suffering that you seek? And so we can understand the Buddha treasure in terms of, so we can look at the three treasures also in terms of the conventional understanding and ultimate understanding. So we can look at Buddha as a historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, as enlightened beings, as every person that has Buddha nature. We can think of the Buddha treasure as the teacher who guides us, of an example, taking refuge in the example of awakened beings, of having faith in our own Buddha nature, which gives us the confidence, encouragement to practice. But what's the ultimate understanding of Buddha nature or of the Buddha treasure? The Dharma treasure is the teachings of the Buddha, of enlightened beings. They are the practices, right? How those teachings are translated through what we actually do. They're the sutras, teachings such as this that we're studying. They're what we do, right? The Dharma treasure is, in a sense, what we do as practitioners. Right? So if you're going to practice the Buddha Dharma, what does that mean? What do you do? What is the ultimate understanding of the Dharma treasure? What's its absolute basis? And then there's the Sangha treasure, which is the community. Traditionally, it's considered the ordained monastic community, but today, these days, it's understood as the whole community of practitioners. So we can think of the resident Sangha. We can think of it as our larger Sangha. We can think of it as those who are training students. We can think of it as anybody and everyone who practices with us. We can think of it as all practitioners. We can think of it as all beings, all human beings. And then we can think of the qualities of the Sangha treasure. Companionship, support, examples, inspiration, encouragement, mutual polishing. Sangha helps to reflect the self back to us so that we can see it. We see how the self arises within us, which is hard to see because we're so used to it. We don't notice it. But when it impacts on other people, they notice it. And they reflect that back. Sometimes they like it, sometimes they don't. And so there is that in the Sangha treasure. So what is taking, and then taking refuge? So there are the three treasures, and then there's taking refuge, right? So what is that? When you take refuge, what are you doing? So Dogen, in the quoting the Chinese character of taking refuge, Kie, he said it's to unreservedly rely upon. Right? The way a child will leap off of a table into the arms of its parents, knowing, having absolute trust that the parent will catch the child. So let's look at that. What is taking refuge? Right. And let me just say before maybe we go there, is that I think what happens when we begin to contemplate the three treasures, but more specifically taking refuge, we will come up against our faith. Because while in a sense there is something that seems tangible in this, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, there is something that isn't, right? As in taking refuge. What is that? And so I remember when I first came into training, you know, the three treasures was, those were words I heard my teacher say. He talked about it. We, you know, it was incorporated, it was in the liturgy that I was doing. And so I was being constantly presented with it and giving my own voice to it. But it was very abstract. It was very distant. It didn't really mean much to me. And that meant both in terms of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I mean, I had, you know, could sort of have some beginning understanding of what that meant in an ordinary sort of accessible way. But I didn't understand what taking refuge meant. And so it was really abstract, even when I took Jikai, you know, because we did things a little differently back then, and not as quite as thorough preparation as we do now. So even when I did that, it was very sort of unclear, and I kind of didn't worry about it. I just thought, I don't know. But as time went on, it was clear that I needed to go a little deeper, right? That there was something happening here. There was something that I was meeting over and over and over and over again. And that no matter what, you know, all that my teacher said that was helpful, that was guiding me and teaching me, that there was something that was, it seemed clear to me, he couldn't give me, right? He couldn't convey to me, not because it wasn't something like that. Right. There was something that I needed to do to sort of bridge that gap that I felt between myself and the and this particular teaching. And so then the role of faith. So the three treasures, I think, really sort of brings us to a place within the Dharma that is of a sort of expressly spiritual or religious realm, religious in the sense of, you know, of this world, but not defined by it. That is, in a sense, inviting us into other realms of mind, of consciousness, of experience, that are not so tangible. And so let's just look at that a little bit. What is taking refuge? If you were to put words to it, right? If you were if someone were to ask you, you know, somebody who doesn't really understand, or somebody who's just asking, you know, what is taking refuge? How? What would you say?
What comes up for me right away is that taking refuge is making a choice about how I want to live my life. Do I want to live it according to the teachings of the Buddha, the reality of the Dharma, the example of the Sangha. And I have to choose. I mean, there's a lot of choices, but I have to commit to living a life according to that choice.
Right. Yeah. And so that can be kind of scary, right? Particularly in the beginning, to have the sense of, you know, being asked or needing to, if you want to go further, to actually make that choice, right? Because there are all of these other things you could take refuge in. There are all of these other things you could follow, you could align yourself with, you could believe in, right? You could give your trust to. And in a sense, to go further, to go into this, you are, in a sense, not so much being asked, but you're asking yourself, you know, what choice, because you are making a choice, right? You have been making choices. We've all been making choices, right? All along the way. Not making choices doesn't really seem like a reality, you know? And so what are the choices we have been making? But in taking refuge and basically in practicing, it makes we come to those moments where it suddenly becomes very clear that to go further, we actually need to do that. And then to do that, what can be that very difficult thing which you gave voice to, which is commitment, that we're actually going to commit to it, to this particular path, to this particular teaching. Right, which is scary for a lot of folks.
You know, what is this on? What came up for me is I immediately thought of a way of asking for help. In other words, when I realized that I was the illusion that I was independent, mm-hmm. and in taking refuge, I had such a strong feeling of now I'm dependent. Now I'm in need of getting help.
Right.
And the three treasures are the way it's going to happen.
Right. Yeah. And that can be a long road to get to that place. For some of us, it certainly was for me. The sense of dependency always had sort of negative associations.
Right.
You know, to be dependent was not a good thing.
Right.
Right. It was an abdication of my agency, of, you know, and so I had to really relearn or understand it in a very different way.
Right, kind of like a humbling of that spirit. Mm.
What about the folks at home? Sergei?
Hello. To me, taking refuge is unreservedly relying on the intangible, that there is nothing to rely on, that it's all, but there's nothing reliable, that there's nothing tangibly to rely on, that they're illusory.
We're not hearing you.
Oh.
Should you?
I think we should add a fourth treasure, and that is the Zoom treasure. It's completely unreliable, just as the three treasures are.
You talking about, or
she's making jokes?
Oh, we're trying to give us a moment, right? Give us a moment. We're trying to fix the problems, and we'll come back to you for questions. Alec,
to me, I have felt like the best way for me personally to describe what taking refuge has felt like for me in this, because I can't quite say what it is, but I can try to describe what it feels like to do it. Mm-hmm. And for me, what it feels like to really describing what...
Describe it either. So it's not necessary to describe it. In a sense, it's impossible to describe it. sort of in the thread of taking refuge, he talks about the teaching about the three things that we should avoid and the three things that we should follow and respect. And those things that we should avoid are seeking refuge in powerful people or worldly gods. So basically all the things that, you know, in ordinary life we're presented with as being the things that we can rely upon, you know, for what we ultimately are seeking and need. And so that is something to avoid, is to, you know, which doesn't mean to not engage in or be involved in those things, but don't attach to them, or don't put on them, don't create unrealistic expectations of what wealth or power or position or a job or a relationship or any of the good things in life can do for us, and understand what, in other words, understand what they can do for us, what they can provide in terms of the goodness of life, but what they can't provide in terms of what we're looking for in a more fundamental sense. So not to take refuge in those things. To forsake all forms of aggression and violence. So it's interesting to think of this in relationship to taking refuge. You know, what are we taking refuge in? Why is it that he says that Kinsey says it needs to be something that is in essence uncorruptible, that in essence isn't something that is created, right? Which then begs the question of, well, but wait a minute, the Buddha was a human being, right? The Dharma were teachings, right? Those didn't just appear. The Sangha is people. We come and go. So how is he speaking of the three treasures in the sense of being uncorruptible or being unconditioned, right? So he's clearly talking about aspects of those treasures, right? The essence, in a sense, you might say, that which we're ultimately taking refuge in, right? Because again, remember, if we're taking refuge in something that's impermanent, in something that is, that comes and goes, it's going to go. And then third is to not distrust or ignore the laws of karma. In other words, to really take to heart, to study, and really gain faith in the law of karma, right? Cause and effect. And then the three things to follow and respect are, first, to respect all representations of Buddha in images and paintings. Second, to respect all teachings and sutras. You know, in our present situation, because we're all the residents have a sutra book that you have at your place, so that we're not, you know, passing them around. And so, because we have not provided you a place to put them, you put them on the floor. That is expressly not to be done. All right. So there's respect all the teachings. And in fact, when a teaching is, you know, if you have a teaching that is no longer being used, or for some reason is not usable, maybe it's very old and torn, then the instruction is to burn it. You know, you don't just throw it in the trash. And then the third is to respect all members of the monastic sangha and practicing sangha, all practitioners. So why is it important, right? It's easier, I think, to understand the things that we are to avoid. But why is it important to respect all representations of Buddha, to respect, you know, in a sense, the way we're handling the teachings, the sutras, texts, and so on? Why is that important, right? You could say they're just books, they're just pieces of paper. They're printed. Images. Why is that important? Peter? Hang on. Wait for a mic. And how are we doing?
Yeah, we're good to go.
We're okay, good.
Well, they're karmic seeds, like texts and pictures. to disrespect them or to destroy them would be to deprive untold numbers of people the opportunity to receive those teachings, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you're destroying wholesome seeds of karma.
Okay. That might need a little more investigation to see into that. Paul, did you want to?
I forgot what I was going to say. Did you have something to say?
Yeah.
Okay, you go first.
So, yeah, I think we have a relationship. Is that what I sound like? I think we have a relationship with either the image or the teachings themselves, and to tarnish that would mean we'd now have a ruined relationship with those teachings or with that image. So when we go back and we need to relieve our suffering, what we associate with it is the anger or the way we've treated it poorly. The karma comes back in that way and harms us.
Okay. Now. So why are we practicing? I mean, what is the point of, why are we practicing?
To relieve our suffering.
Right. To liberate our minds of attachments, of false views, of these cyclic patterns that exist within us emotionally, mentally, so on. So everything is based in that, right? So if ever, you know, we encounter a teaching that we might not understand, to look at it from that point of view. So if I am not respecting, right? So first of all, there could be, I haven't taken refuge. None of this means anything to me. And I am disrespectful. Okay. Like this image or this teaching means no more to me than anything else. So I treat it with disrespect. Right. And so how is that harmful to the person? If you have taken refuge, right? If you are relying, you have made that choice, you are committed, and you disrespect, then what is happening? So remember, it's always coming back to your mind. It's always tracing itself back to your mind. So in that moment of disrespect, what's happening in your mind?
I mean, you plant a seed of anger of some kind of malevolence that then comes back to you in some form.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's that strong or whether it's just, you know, disrespectful, it's disregard, it's a kind of desecration, right, of something that is in and of itself good, right, and whose whole purpose is to heal you of all your ills, right, and so when we in that disrespect, we're in a sense training, we're still involved in mind training, but now how are we training our mind? Right? We're training it in a different way. Right? And so it's, you know, it's about how I am relating to, how I am seeing, how I experience, right? That's coming back, flowing back and forth between myself and this image or this teaching or this person, this community.
Yeah, so I remember what I was going to say. So in taking refuge, you're considering these three gems as sacred, right? And so the acts of disrespecting would be counteracting that. It would be desecrating it, and within your mind, like it would be training your mind to do something other than taking refuge.
Right. And if we really understand what Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is, where the fundamental disrespect is of oneself. Right. So this idea that we can compartmentalize, you know, that I can love this but hate this, that I can, you know, revere this but want to destroy that, you know, is just a trickery. Right, and that we can keep those things distinct, right? Do I have anything coming in?
There's some people
Okay. Can you give Laurel a mic?
So in the chat, people have said, respecting the images and texts prepare me
can
to receive.
Can you hold that closer to your mic?
Yeah. Respecting the images and texts prepares me to receive the teachings. Mm-hmm. That's Fuyu. And Emma says, texts and pictures represent our mind. That is why we care for them. Joe Raymond said, the images are the Buddha mind of the creator artist speaking to the Buddha mind in us. We should respect such an image as one Buddha speaking to another. Mm-hmm. Nicole says, you are breaking the trust in the relationship. Mm-hmm. And JB says, the essence of our practice needs to be experienced in our body. Our actions towards these representations are the only real manifestation of our understanding. It's not something that can be described but felt. Mm-hmm. And some Jim Sanzen also said we can get too attached to images.
What?
We can get too attached to images.
Yes, yes. Which in a way you could say is a subtle kind of disrespect, right? Because in that attachment, we have turned it into something, right? In a way, it's not, you know, in a fundamental way, it's not really different from attaching to wealth or position or power or something else. In other words, we've turned it into something that we can gain, we can possess, because attachment is about position.
And so that's it creates a very
dynamic, you know, which I think is so beautiful and so essential, you know, is how do you sort of cultivate that kind of relationship internally and not have it begin to become poisonous, you know, not have it become attachment, right? And so what's your safeguard from that happening? How do you help keep that from happening within yourself? Eduardo?
Well, that's what I have a question about, because these three points, I thought that the things to avoid sounded, you know, pretty reasonable. But these three things to do, like other points in the teaching, they sound pretty limited, like pretty, you know, separating. This is kind of the lesser life, and this is the good life. This is the holy. This is the mundane. These are the images that you should contemplate with reverence. Mm-hmm. And then what about the rest?
Yeah. Well, it's true. And, I mean, it's true that I think it could be understood that way. And, remember that these early teachings are presented, I mean, the way he speaks about it is it presented for those with smaller capacity. But I think a better way of looking at it is that, and I think I spoke about this at the beginning, is that, you know, we enter in from the place where things do have power, right? And so, you know, a green piece of paper that has a one on it is different than a green piece of paper that has 100 on it, right? Those two pieces of paper are different. They have different levels of power. And so it's sort of addressing us at that point in our own place, you know, in our own understanding, and trying to, in a sense, I mean, that's sort of the Hinayana practice in the beginning is more of a renunciant, you know, so there's, you know, avoiding those places, is being careful about those relationships, is being wary of those possessions, right? Because they still have power. Not because they do inherently, but because they do in our mind. And so the beginning practice is more of a letting go and in a sense, a kind of pulling back or a kind of temporary turning away, right? So that we can begin to gain our sanity a little bit, mm-hmm. and our stability, so that then when we turn towards those very familiar things that have huge forces within, right? Well, our own history, but also socially, then we're on a little bit more stable ground to begin to see into that non-dual nature. Yeah. Okay, Lauren?
Scott asks, how do we rely on something we are not attached to?
Indeed. Good question. My suggestion is that we all practice taking refuge. All the time, in many, so many ways, in a certain way, we have to wait, and it's not so much a matter of waiting, but we have to wait until we are ready to engage a particular practice or a particular teaching on our own. You know, we can engage it when we're in the Zendo and we're all doing it together. Like I can make those words come out of my mouth, right? So I did that in the beginning. So I would, when we were taking refuge, I would take refuge. But it wasn't mine yet. Right, I wasn't quite ready to sort of enter into it or invite it into me in that way, but I was preparing myself, right, unwittingly, unknowingly. I was engaging in the practices, and I was also questioning. You know, somebody recently came and was asking questions about taking refuge in the three treasures, and just spilled out a whole bunch of questions, you know, like how to understand this, how to engage this, how to deepen this. And I said, that's how. I didn't have to do anything. I said, what's happening right now, that's how it happens. Is you're engaged, right? You're asking those questions. You're wanting to know. That's how it happens. But I think when we take it up. So if you make that a part of your practice to take refuge. And you can do it in your morning sitting. You can do it when you're bowing, when you're doing your three bows. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. But in doing that, you are the master, right? You are choosing, right, to engage in that teaching in that way, and it's coming completely from within yourself. That's how it comes to life. Faizan?
When we were studying this, I was thinking about what does it really mean, you know, to take, it was this very question, what does it mean to take refuge? And then three treasures. And I wonder if it, keeping the precepts, you know, I wonder if that has something that might, you know, because you were talking about it has to do with what actions I'm taking, which I think it does. And I think that keeping the precepts has something to do with.
So if you look at the Bodhisattva precepts, which Dogen said he brought back from Chuching in China, we begin with taking refuge. Right, and then there are the pure precepts, and then there are the 10 great precepts, and the last of the great precepts is to not defile the three treasures. So it really goes back to that precept is really speaking about that action of avoiding disrespecting Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So again, it's about really recognizing the importance, the power of this relationship, and what. You know, I was thinking about this. I think, you know, taking refuge in a way is what, I don't know how to say it. It's like, it's what brings warmth into our relationship with these practices, which can all too easily be, you know, methods, techniques, things that you're doing with your body, with your mind, right? And even aspirations and, you know, the stuff of practice can be kind of mental, you know, mentalized. And I think taking refuge cuts through that. And that's why I think the word is so powerful. So Alec talked about sort of being wrapped up, you know, in a womb, kind of. You didn't say that, but there is that. And we can think of refuge as a kind of protection. Like, you know, I'm in a safe, you know, place where nothing can happen. Nothing can hurt me. And it's not that. Because it's not apart from anything. But there is that sense. It certainly has that sense of somehow it is a refuge, you know. And so to think about, you know, when you're distressed, when things are falling apart, are the three treasures refuges? Like, are those places you turn? Right? Are the teachings like the first place you go? Right? Or do you go to MSNBC or, you know, or, you know, just popular opinions about things?
You come. What's come to mind for me is taking refuge. I feels like there was nothing else I could do anymore. Like that was it. And if it's not this, it's nothing. And so there is that quality.
So you better make it work.
Yes, this or nothing.
Yeah.
You know, there's nowhere else to go.
Exactly. I mean, because by God, you got to make it work.
Yeah,
right?
I'm trying.
Yeah. That's what it looks like. But in a way, as long as there are other refuges that we still have faith in, right?
And of course we are. That's where we see ourselves
going in odd moments.
But as that begins to shift, you know, in the sense of,
you know, not having an option can be very freeing. That's the commitment. That's the power of commitment. You know, and it's not, it's given freely. I mean, I may feel like for me, based on my experience, you know, there is, you know, I don't have faith that there is anything outside of this for me. And that can sound like a very desperate place, but it's, and it can feel desperate at times, but it's actually very freeing because now I know where I need to point my direction, right? And when I start to wander away from that, I know where I need to return because in my mind, there isn't another place, you know. Let's look at the next verse because it kind of takes this the next step. So the suffering of the lower realms, so difficult to bear, is the fruit of wrong deeds or harmful actions, so the Buddha taught. Therefore, even at the cost of your life, never to commit negative actions is the conduct of a bodhisattva. And so here the lower realms, he's again talking about these realms of existence, cyclic existence, specifically the three lower realms of the hell realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the animal realm. And so these are realms, the realms that are most marked by suffering, by constriction, by a lack of freedom, by a lack of sort of relative pleasures. So the hell realm is a place that is void of even a fleeting moment of pleasure, right? It's a place of no relief whatsoever. But there are also the realms where there's very little possibility within those realms to leap, right? To encounter the Dharma in a meaningful way because we're so bound by our circumstances. And so he's saying the suffering of those realms, which is so difficult to bear, is the result of our past actions. Therefore, even at the cost of our life, to never commit more negative actions, not to continue to create negative actions. So the Dalai Lama in his commentary on this, said, with this stanza, the text starts speaking about what kind of practice to engage in once we have taken refuge. Right? So this is a very important point. So having taken refuge, what should we be doing? And he says, when one takes refuge, one is primarily taking refuge in true cessations, right, and in true paths. So what he's saying, what we're really engaged in or taking refuge in is actually bringing cessation to those cycles, right, to all of those energies, those patterns, those behaviors, those things that we've been spinning, that we're taking refuge in trying to bring those into true cessation and in a true path in which to be doing that. He says the true cessations are states of abandonment, of defilements, and the true paths are what brings them about. Therefore, to actualize the meaning of taking refuge, one has to engage in the practice. The first level of practice is to restrain our harmful actions and to engage in virtuous actions. Cease from harm, practice good, actualize good for others. Okay, so he's really making it very clear that in order to, that what refuge, taking refuge means is in a sense synonymous with engaging in the practice. So even to think of, you know, taking refuge and now what should I be practicing as though I haven't been, of course, doesn't make sense, right? I'm not going to arrive at the point where I can actually take refuge without practice. I mean, I say that, I'm going to say that that's, I think would be true in most cases. Maybe somebody would just spontaneously, you know, without practice, be at a place of such faith. Why not? Kensei also said, once you have taken refuge, it's important, Kensei said, once you have taken refuge, it's important to act in accordance with the teachings. So having made that decision, having made that commitment, which is an internal thing, right? So that's something I am choosing to do within myself. Nobody's telling me to do that. So when I act in accordance with that, I'm strengthening that, right? I'm confirming and affirming that. When I don't do that, then I'm turning against that within myself. And that, I think, is the most difficult burden to carry, is when we turn against our inner sense of what is true. And so he goes on to talk about the 10 unwholesome actions as those things we should not engage in. So the Buddha taught the 10 unwholesome deeds. Those basically embody themselves for us in the precepts. Okay, so they overlap. There's not killing, not stealing, not misusing sexuality, not lying. So the one distinctive aspect of the unwholesome deeds is that they incorporate all of the four aspects of not right speech. So lying, harsh speech, divisive speech, and idle chatter or gossip. And then ill will or anger, covetousness or greed, and wrong views, delusion. And so those are the deeds, the negative actions that we're trying to cease from engaging in. And then at the same time, as the Dalai Lama says, to be engaging in their virtuous side, right? Which means affirming life, being generous, engaging in healthy, loving sexuality, being truthful, using speech that unites rather than divides, that heals rather than harms, that is helpful rather than unhelpful, and so on. And the Dalai Lama, in his commentary, speaks quite a bit about karma. You know, so one of the things that's interesting is, you know, when you're reading a commentary, like this on these verses. And then the teacher may in your mind seem to go off. Like, why are they talking about this? Right? We were just talking about, why are they going off in this direction? Right? And that's always a good thing to note and sort of like stop and go, huh, what's the connection, right? If you're not seeing it yet. And so he talks about karma. And he says karma basically means action. All of the things that are produced externally and so come forth by all of these things that are produced externally and come forth by way of our own actions. He said daily life is nothing but the result of our daily actions. Today's experience is a result of a previous time's actions. One must accept this pairing of action and experience. This is the law of karma. And this is a really fundamental thing. You know, because Buddhism isn't dogmatic, you know, it's not like you take a creed, adhere to a creed. And yet there are these teachings that you encounter that says you must, like if you don't really have faith in this whole thing's just not really going to work. Right? It's just not going to work. Of course, we don't have to have faith in it. We don't have to believe in it. But if we want this to work, then what that teaching is saying is we really have to deal with this particular teaching and understand why would these teachers say that? You know, why did the Buddha say you can't actually practice and realize yourself without understanding karma? Right? That's a very declarative statement. Thubten Chodron said, this verse is saying, if you don't like lower rebirths, then stop creating the cause for them. If you don't want to end up in the same place, stop taking the path to the same place. And Kensei talked about the four points that we need to consider. In a sense, this is what we gain faith in when we consider karma. One is that it is certain. It's a certainty. Right? Whether you believe in it or not, whether you like it or not, whether you have faith in it or not, it's the way things work. It cannot be avoided. That the result of our actions tend to increase. That's their inclination. Not to go the other way. So whatever we do that leads to a certain result, that result is going to tend to increase, get larger, stronger, more powerful, more dominating. That's its nature. We'll never experience anything that is not a result of a past action, right? Things don't just appear out of nowhere. And that the seeds that we create with our actions, our karmic seeds, he said, are never wasted. It's very interesting. And they never disappear. They never go away. So why this emphasis on karma within these commentaries in relationship to this verse about not continuing to create negative actions? It might seem obvious, or it might not, but questions that seem self-evident are always good to contemplate, because sometimes it's not true.
Could you repeat the question?
Why this emphasis on karma in relationship to this verse, right? The verse is very clear. Just really commit yourself to not committing negative actions. Just do that. Okay, it's very clear. Simple. That's the conduct of a bodhisattva, right? So why get into all this about karma?
Can you hear me? Well, I was just thinking about the precepts. I wanted to demonstrate that it's working now. And so other people won't be afraid to try it. But I also was thinking in terms of understanding cause and effect, that it's like with the bodhisattva precepts that, you know, you keep the precepts so that your regrets don't get in the way of helping others. You're not only do you not want your actions to harm people while you're trying to help them, but also your decisions, have an impact on your own ability to let go of your own self-concerns. Did it have something to do with that?
Oh, sorry, I'm having a cramp. So the relationship between that and the question about the relevance of karma?
Oh, the relevance of karma, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, he's saying that this is a practice of, this is related to the practice of the Bodhisattva, that the Bodhisattva has to be clear on how karma works.
Because
one doesn't want to be, I mean, for there's so many reasons why one does not want to be creating bad karma when they're on the bodhisattvic path. But I was relating it to what we learn in precept studies about wanting to be clear in one's actions so that one's own negative actions don't have an impact on our on the way we can freely relate with others. If we have a lot of regret about our actions, that can be a burden on the way we relate with others.
Okay.
And then of course our activities just are not clean.
Yeah, I would agree with all that, but why not just focus your attention on not committing negative actions? Why have to get all involved in this question of karma and just stop doing those things that are causing harm?
You're asking, why can you not cease from harm without understanding the law of karma?
Yeah. I mean, if you see that what you're doing is harmful, and you want to stop it, to stop doing that, just stop doing it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what's your, other than it being harmful, I mean, understanding why something is harmful is understanding the law of cause and effect. How can you separate them?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are lots of people, in fact, you know, who know nothing about karma and understand that if I do this, this is harmful.
Mm.
You know, they don't know anything about any sort of they've not examined or don't have any Buddhist understanding of karma.
Well, I'm still not sure what you're looking for, because it's like, if I see something, an action of mine is harmful, that's cause and effect. It doesn't go into the deeper meanings that the Buddha taught about, you know, that suggest reincarnation or suggest a broader picture of cause and effect. But that's the very basis of cause and effect. I do something, there's a negative result. Mm-hmm. I do something positive, I plant a positive seed, there's a positive result.
Okay. All right. Is anybody else? Laurel?
We have three hands up, but I could be an opportunity.
I'm going to say, I think what I was relating to is more the, you know, rebirth in a, or whatever, lower realm, and the relationship between karma, acceptance, and refuge in that situation. So kind of understanding that, you know, okay, whatever is happening that you are taking refuge in is a result of past karma, which you untraceable, right? The present moment and the what you're doing as, you know, like a right action in the present moment is that. But what's arising in the face of making that choice of doing the right action, the challenge of it, or the pain of it, whatever realm that you're in, is a result of past action. Mm-hmm. And so what's important, I guess, to realize about that is, say, as that sort of hell realm is happening and arising, that understanding karma maybe can create a positive action in the face of negative circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the thing is that there are so many times where we don't necessarily know. It may not always be clear if something is a negative action. And even if it is, there may oftentimes be something positive that we want. And even when we sort of are disciplined or whatever, and we resist, you know, a negative action and do something positive, like Hokyu said, positive action brings a positive consequence, but that's not always true. It doesn't always seem to be true, right? And so that teaching on the three times of karma, that karma unfolds in different time periods, right? Which means we may not see the results of an action for a long time or ever. And so then how are we supposed to be encouraged or inspire ourselves to do something when we would like certain results and we don't see them happening, right? And so that's why, you know, if we understand that karma is a certainty, then it's easier to have faith that I may not be seeing the consequences, but there are consequences, right? And so that we, because there's so many instances in practice, just as a practitioner, you know, doing formal practice where you're sort of asking yourself or being encouraged to do something that is not the first thing on your list, right? And there's that sense of how do you, you know, bring yourself to that? How do you have faith in that? For you?
I think studying karma is how I can verify the teachings of the precepts. I think it's like you were just saying that it's not always obvious. It's not so obvious that do a good action, get a good result. You know, you might not be able to see that, or it might not seem that way. But understanding karma helps understand, you know, why practice these precepts, even if it's not immediately obvious, you know, why do them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it can also help us to understand, because, you know, as human beings, we want to understand. You know, we want to understand our world. We want to understand why things happen the way they do, right? Why we do the things we do, why we are the person we are, why other people are who they are, why things are happening the way they are. And so understanding karma can really give us, you know, very deep insight into the thoughts that we have, the impulses that we experience, the way we respond to things, our reactions, you know, and understand them as a consequence, right, of not only our own past actions, but of things that, you know, the whole environment that we've lived in, you know, throughout our lives, and how all of that has been, you know, sort of brought into our consciousness and then comes out in things that we do, our daily actions. It can help us to understand other people, right? Without even knowing them or knowing anything about them, when you see a person acting in a certain way, you can make certain reasonable assumptions without knowing the details about that person's life, right? About the, when you see particularly patterns, you know, the things that would have likely led to these behaviors being, you know, manifesting in the person, right? So it helps us to understand ourselves and each other in a way that helps to check that tendency to turn people into absolute intrinsic beings, you know, who are equal to their actions, you know, or are nothing but their actions, you know. But we see that there's, you know, that's why before the election, when PBS did a special on Hillary Clinton and Trump and their backgrounds, you know, into their lives, their families, their upbringing, it was incredibly helpful, you know, to see the same language that he brings forth that his father used, and the kind of relationship that they had, and the, you know, and it wasn't, it didn't seem very good.
You could feel the momentum.
Huh?
You could feel the momentum of karma, like it's not.
Don't you? Yeah. Say it.
I was just saying you could feel the momentum of the action when it's not broken, and how it just accumulates, right. Accumulates, because it's based on, there's nothing, if we're saying it's based on, it's absolutely empty and it can be anything at all, mm-hmm. then what we're seeing is, wow, this momentum,
exactly.
in all these different places just happening, you know, from actions, right. from actions.
And you see how the results of actions tend to increase.
And how they increase, and what it takes to, like, well, what it takes to, like, stop.
Right. And that the, and what people take refuge in.
Yeah.
In other words, what people hold up as, you know, their sacred shrine.
Yeah, and how that self, right. keeps,
and when you see, and you see that, and then you see how that is not satisfying, right? I mean, you don't necessarily know the internal machinations of that person, but you can see that it's not satisfying because it has to keep increasing,
right? So
they can never arrive,
right? And if you're suffering, then that's a cue that it's hasn't cleared,
right? And then how that suffering, that mind view, becomes broadcast.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes our world, right? And then everyone who sort of enters into our orbit, into our realm, sort of enters into that. And so the more powerful a person is, you know, charismatically, in terms of their personality, in terms of the position they have, you know, the role that they have, you know, then they're field of operation becomes more and more potent, you know, and in that way has the potential to do tremendous harm or
yeah.
a heap of good.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so we can see, you know, when we study karma, I think it helps us to, you know, not see the world as just a random place or people as just like inherently bad actors, but we see, in a sense, everyone acting out, you know, the self, but also that it really goes back so to the beginning, you know, these things get formed so early in us.
So if we look at Fusatsu, why we start off with atonement, mm-hmm. you know, to acknowledge that momentum in a way, to right. clear, at least I recognize it before we go on to
exactly
anything else,
right? And trying to with the intention to break the cycle,
yeah,
right, to interrupt the cycle. And so that's why when Dalai Lama says that taking refuge is taking refuge in a true cessation, that we're trying to break those cycles of behavior, of patterns, of thinking, of acting, right? Which is why it's so important to, you know, practice within spaces that are, you know, at times more spare, you know, where things can be slowed down. You don't have to, you're not reacting to so many things so that you can really see those things happening in more vivid detail. Say you? I'm assuming that's why you're...
I was just going to say, you know, there's been a lot said that was on my mind, which is that, you know, our karma, without studying our karma, we don't understand a lot about how we respond. And I know, knowing something about the patterns that have led me to respond to people that I have intentions to help, knowing that those patterns have conditioned me to respond that way, I can sort of be on the lookout for them. And that they don't come from, you know, they're not just randomly appearing out of the blue. And that also understanding something about karma, as you said, that I understand in a general way why other people might be, supposedly or like what appears to be harmful, you know, but in their mind, I don't know that they know they're being harmful. Mm-hmm. And to meet that person in a different way that's not so judgmental and condemning, and then I have a chance to offer something positive.
Yeah. And, you know, what's important, and I think we need to keep saying again and again, is none of this, you know, this understanding is not in any way intended to be sanctioning or, you know, being passive towards harmful actions, our own or others. It's not, you know, okay, now I understand that you're, you know, acting out of your result, you know, out of your past actions. And so I have compassion for you. And so, you know, just carry on. That it's embedded within this vow to alleviate suffering, ours and others, right? So there is this commitment that we are making to try and actually break the cycle, not just for ourselves, but for everyone, right? And so then if you think of, you know, if you look at karma, and then and reflect on it and then think about, rather than just this body, this person, think of the person being a country, right? Or a family or a corporation, right? Or a period of time. In other words, where the body is sort of a collection that is manifesting and has a certain mindset, if you will. So if you think about that in terms of white supremacy or in terms of patriarchy, right, or in terms of any sort of, overarching view, right, of oneself and others. And so then a group, you know, a group, say, of, say, white people, becomes a body, right, that in a sense begins to manifest, even though you've got, you know, individuals who are, you know, acting independently and not all believing the same and actually maybe working, you know, to liberate those false views, you know, that there can be a sort of a dominant force within that body, right, which in a way creates a kind of collective karma, right? And then when you think about shifting that, breaking that cycle, breaking those cycles, and how difficult that is, how difficult it is to do that, and then to think, well, how difficult is it for me to break my own cycles? And it's just me, right? It's just one person, my mind. You know, then it helps me to sort of be more patient sometimes and to hold, you know, the complexity and the difficulty of the challenges we face. But at the same time, without sort of translating that into, well, you know, it's complicated and it's going to take a long time, so let's just not apply ourselves. So I just want to make it clear that's not at all what this is. This is really, the whole point of this is to move us into activity. Anshin?
When you first asked that question about stanza eight, about, you know, let me see, yeah, never act unvirtuously. Why tie that to the concept of karma? My one of my thoughts was on a more like mundane and pragmatic level that it incentivizes good behavior if you believe that, if you know, that many religions do that. The whole concept of heaven and hell is to incentivize good behavior.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So that it does act on a societal level in that way.
Yeah.
And I would, go ahead.
Go ahead, please.
I would love for you, I brought this up before in a different context, but sort of the same question, and I would love for you to respond again, because I don't really remember what you said last time, although it was helpful. And that is, if you believe in a strict understanding of karma, how do we explain the centuries of suffering for people of color?
The power of white, the power of white supremacy. You know,
But is it saying that because they were born into a life with black skin, that it's because they did, you know, I mean, I hate that thought, and I've had trouble with the concept of karma because of that very thing.
I do too. And so that is how the Buddha taught karma. He, you know, there are sutras where he's quite explicit about actions in this life will yield this kind of misfortune in the next life. Even, you know, in the way of physical, you know, deformities or, you know. And so, yeah, I have a whole bunch of trouble with that. Because it has been used in most, it seems, religions to sanction the oppression of people, right?
Yeah.
And so I don't understand it that way. So when Kensei says, you will never experience anything that is not the result of a past action, that could be understood as, your past action has caused this moment where you are being, you know, oppressed or treated unfairly or, but I don't understand it that way. I mean, sometimes that's true, obviously, but I mean, just in ordinary life, you know, but we could you could understand that as your experience of this moment, what is happening to you, right? What is happening to you may be the result of, you know, hundreds of years of systems and, you know, ideologies and so on, you know, that have created these systems of oppression. Mm-hmm. That's not your, if that's happening to you, that's not your fault, right? I don't see that as a result of your past actions. But what is true is your experience of it, which is in your mind, does belong to you. Your experience of it, how you are experiencing that, and how you respond to it, is going to be a result of your karma, right? Of your life's experiences, right? And so to sort of, you see what I'm saying? I'm sort of tease them apart. And so one is what is happening to you. And so there is injustice, right? There is a person acting upon an innocent, right? Where the innocent is an innocent. And then, but now that person is has been impacted in a way that has is affecting them. And how and what that effect is a result of their karma. It is also completely changeable, right? I mean, isn't that what we're doing in practice, is we're learning how to experience things? We're not really experiencing anything new. We're still in samsara. We're experiencing the same old stuff, right? Inside and outside, I mean, for the most part. But we're learning how to experience it in a different way. Not just respond in a different way, but to actually experience it.
Yes, okay.
The actual experience of what is happening.
Yeah.
And that's something that is within our control, because it's our mind. Right? Now, the karma that I have created or the person has created that makes them or leads them to respond in different ways or makes it easier or harder to respond in certain ways in that moment, that's not entirely of their doing, right? Because all along the way, we have each been influenced by everything around us. And so if I grew up in a very difficult environment, you know, let's say where the models around me are models of violence, right? That doesn't mean that I am determined to respond that way, but it might be much easier for me to respond that way. And so when I respond that way, that is the result of my karma, but it's not just of my own doing. So even then, right, when we talk about, when I say that it's, you know, my experience of it is my karma, that's still not just me as an independent, separate individual. So they're just, which really means they're just these layers, if you will, of mutual responsibility that we have for each other, right? Because how we are with each other is affecting each of us in ways that is making it easier or harder for us to, in essence, be a good person, you know, and it's very basic. But I think that point that Anshin made is because, and we're going to encounter it a lot in the coming verses, right? This idea that you know, when somebody's angry at you, or when somebody's, you know, slandering you, or when somebody's wanting to chop your head off, that's a result of your past actions, right? So I agree. I think that we need to be very careful about not understanding it in that particular way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Right. Not in any categorical sense. Yeah. Okay. Anybody in the room before we go back to the screen? We have a couple of minutes left. Okay. Vadim?
Shugan, my way of trying to deal with this issue of responsibility is to also realize that in our culture, we have been brought up to look on the individual as the center of power. And this is a misconception because, in fact, we do have a structure, you know, systems of oppression and so on that change us and change us in ways that we aren't conscious of. And so I look at people like a great psychiatrist and writer, philosopher named Frantz Fanon, who came up with a different way of looking at the way structures in society work, which is sociogenic, you know, that we have structures that we aren't aware of that influence even things like, you know, are you crazy or are you not? He was a psychiatrist. among other things. He was also a radical revolutionary. And there's so much to unlearn about the way our culture, besides the racism and the sexism and all, our culture has focused us that helps the economic structure and the political power structure to continue. That when we look at the personal responsibility, we also have to look at the familial responsibility and the social responsibility. And in my case as a white male, as our privileged responsibilities. And it's not easy. It's just not easy. But I just wanted to share a something that I've been wrestling with for a number of years, and that I'm trying to find ways to take the language of the Bodhisattva and to incorporate it in a framework, a worldview that's broader than what my culture has given me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think just take the teachings and apply them, you know, bring them into all that you're studying. And you're right, it's not easy, but you know, being deluded is harder, right? And much more expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the problem, is that samsara seems easy, right? I mean, it's like our culture is, you know, sort of, it's going to be death by convenience. Because things have been made so easy, right, for us, by making them infinitely harder for others.
Yes.
And so to break out of that bubble, you know, so for those of us who have been in a bubble where things have been made easy, you know, to willingly leave that. But in a way, is that any different, you know, than entering into the path? You know, that we're sort of choosing to leave behind many of the refuges we've turned towards, right? And that initially that seems much harder. That seems much harder. But the thing is, it usually we're motivated by suffering in the beginning, because we're already seeing it's not working. And what's so difficult about these larger social, you know, and sort of identity systems,
mm-hmm.
that it can be much harder for people within the dominant groups to see their own suffering.
Right.
And that's a great challenge. So. Okay. Huh? Oh, sorry. Vadim?
I just want to mention how all of the various facets of the teaching seem to work together, and
isn't that nice?
It's quite remarkable.
Indeed.
I think you mentioned a lot when we come into practice, there is a certain aspects that really resonate with us, and other aspects we just, you know, sort of not in touch with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what comes to me is faith and self-study as two complementary sort of forces. As I'm practicing and I'm studying the self and seeing actually how karma works and how it can be altered, it can be released, that in turn gives me faith to explore deeper. And so and to engage the other teachings that seem a bit more remote. And so, I think that what came up for me, you know, when you were speaking about karma and the precepts, you know, something that I was not immediately, you know, engaged with, just investigating and seeing. And I also want to bring Zazen into that mix, because that sort of gives the, that's the ground in which that studies is takes place, to see that. Yeah, I mean, it's not easy, you know. I mean, I'm sure we all know that it's like moment to moment effort, and so. But seeing that how things do shift, that gives a little more of the. I think that's what you're saying, but bodhicitta. So it's faith, but it's not a blind faith. It's faith that's built on evidence that, you know, take one and another next step forward, and then it increases, it snowballs.
Yeah. Faith is not to, you know, have something within us that sits there. It's very active, right? It's very alive. And it brings us, it helps to bring us into contact. And I think, you know, my feeling is to not worry, you know, if there are aspects of training or practice that, you know, don't really resonate, you don't feel that affinity, you may not understand, you know, to not worry about that, but to inquire, you know, to engage. I think it's one of the really important things about training is we come into contact with things we wouldn't or might not if we were by ourselves. We come into, you know, different teachings and so on and just different practices. And that just opens doors and it creates a possibility. You know, because the thing is the more we practice and encounter in a true way, the more we are going to gain confidence, right? Because if we don't, confidence is born out of those experiences of resonance, right? If we're engaging something and there's no resonance, it's not going to give us confidence because there's no resonance. And that's fine. You know, I mean, that just may mean that's just not an important element of your practice, right? It's not that, you know, everybody is supposed to end up in the same place. It's never been like that. But I think what I think is important is just to keep the doors, keep our mind open. You know, just because something doesn't speak to us, that's all. It just doesn't speak to us. Maybe that's forever. Maybe it's just for now. You know, but as a person of the way, a person on the path, I mean, it's dynamic, you know, and it we should be encountering. It's like a journey, you know. If you're not encountering, you don't go on a journey in a around a circle, you know, seeing the same old stuff. You want to be seeing new things, being encountering new things. Okay, so we will. I think this is the last of these sessions we're going to do. You might be wondering, how are we going to finish all these? I said at the beginning, I have a plan. I also said, we'll see what happens. But I have confidence. We're going to, during the ongoing intensive, we're going to be taking up some groups of verses that kind of work together. So I wanted in the beginning to really be working slowly through some of these because it was really laying some foundation, but I'm hopeful.
Can you share one thing from the chat?
Huh?
Can you just share something from the chat?
Yes.
I just wanted to share, Carol Musso said in response to when you were talking about, those that are oppressed.
Can you turn the mic up, Ken?
Carol said, perhaps those who suffer greatest from systemic oppression are actually bodhisattvas, teaching us something about ourselves. That might be their karmic response. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to share that.
Well, we have the capacity to learn from everyone and everything. And that's not just a Buddhist thing. That's just a human thing. So why shouldn't we? Thank you, everyone. Sorry for all of the technical troubles in the beginning. Thank you for those who ironed those out. Just part of the deal, right? Happens now and then. let's end with the four vows. So we'll chant the four vows. Okay.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma Talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.